بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
As he traveled to Persia and Mesopotamia, Ibn Battuta was, for the first time, moving outward from the heart of Darul Islam, following its northeastward axis from Makkah to Mukarramah. Once he crossed the Tigris, near its mouth, he entered a land through which a tribe of fair-skinned conquerors, the Aryans, had passed so long ago that they were now remembered only by the name they left, Iran. What he saw and heard there, the faces, the languages, the style of the minarets, the governments, the arts, were all still Islamic. But this was a different cultural domain within Islamic culture. The land ruled the Ilkhans. Since 1258, when the Mongols took the city, Baghdad, and much of Iraq to the west had also been a part of the Ilkhanid domains. In the middle of 1327, Ibn Battuta crossed the Tigris again via Kufa, arrived in the once great city. 14th century Baghdad was a city where the marketplace of ideas was as rich and as noisy as any other of the souks. The devastation the Mongols had wrought 69 years earlier was catastrophic, but under the Sultan Abu Sa'id Bahadur Khan, the last of the king of the Tatars, who converted to Islam, Baghdad was attempting to revive the brilliance and prosperity that had characterized it during its Abbasid heyday, roughly from the 8th to the 11th century. That had been a time when China's palaces might have been richer and Cordoba's philosophers deeper. Baghdad was still the world's greatest confluence of intellect, commerce, art, trade, and religion. The richest volume on history's bookshelf. Much of Ibn Battuta's account of the city is mournful, for, in his time, the western side of the city, where the Khalif al-Ma'mun had built the great Bayt al-Hikmah, House of Wisdom, and other monuments, was largely a vast edifice of ruins. The mantle of greatness and the Khalifate itself had shifted to Cairo, which the Mongols never reached. Still, for fame, allure, and its aura of history, Baghdad was still the queen of the Tigris, a name to conjure with. As for Ibn Battuta, in addition to describing visits to the mosques and madrasas supported by nobles or by the Sultan himself, he faithfully and factually notes Baghdad's bridges, fountains, baths, fortresses, palaces, workshops, factories, mills, and magnificent bazaars, splendidly laid out. In the eastern city, where most settlement was concentrated in the early 14th century, the average workman's house were humble rectangles of sun-dried brick. Streets were wide enough for two loaded donkeys to pass. The same width in Baghdad as in Seville in Spain. Better homes had a courtyard, a water basin, a shade tree, and ornamental plants. Outward displays of wealth were avoided. From the outside, no door or window revealed or hinted at the status of the inhabitants within. Inside, water splashed from fountains or was stored in unglazed urns. Everything that could be decorated was. Brilliant colors were prized. The Qa'da, or code of social behavior that governed life in these homes, were much the same in Baghdad as it was back in Ibn Battuta's Tangier, or virtually anywhere else in the Muslim world. In Baghdad, Ibn Battuta determined to return to Mecca for his second Hajj. The Sultan himself invited Ibn Battuta to accompany his caravan northward, and Ibn Battuta accepted. For 10 days, he traveled with the Mahalla, or camp, of Abu Sa'id. His description of the journey's routines is unusually detailed, perhaps because of the impression the journey made on him, or because in retrospect, the practices of the Ilkhans were of particular interest to the Moroccan Sultan under whose patronage he recollected his travels.
It is their custom to set out with the rising of the dawn and to encamp in the late forenoon. The ceremonial is as follows. Each of the Amirs comes up with his troops, his drums and his standards, and halts in a position that has been assigned to him, not a step further, either on the right wing or the left wing. When they have all taken up their positions and their ranks are set in perfect order, the king mounts, and the drum sounded for the departure. Each of the Amirs advances, salutes the king, and returns to his place. Then the marshals move forward ahead of the king. Then come the Sultan's baggage and baggage animals, and finally, the rest of the army.
After parting from the Mahalla, Ibn Battuta's itinerary took him, among other places, to the cities of Shiraz, Isfahan, and to Tabriz. which had become a major center of Islamic Mongol influence and power. In the latter city, he regretted being able to remain only one night without having met any of the scholars. Although his haste was due to the arrival of an order for his escort to join Sultan Abu Sa'id's Mahalla. At that time, Ibn Battuta received his first audience with the Sultan and a promise of provisions for his intended second Hajj. Now here's something interesting to note. Starting about 1260, a generation before Ibn Battuta's birth, a great rebuilding of Mongol-devastated Persia began. By the time Ibn Battuta arrived there, the city of Tabriz could count at least one truly great son, Rashid ad-Din, statesman, administrative reformer, and historian. He was of such great political shrewdness that he survived being co-wazir to no fewer than three Ilkhanid sultans. One of them, worried that the Mongols, as they settled in Persia as Muslims, might forget their origins, commissioned him to write a history of the Mongols. The Sultan's successor ordered him to expand it to cover all peoples with whom the Mongols had come in contact. Rashid thus produced what had been called the first true world history, titled Jami' al-Tawarikh. It covered the entirety of Dar al-Islam, plus China, Tibet, Turkey, Byzantium, and non-Muslim Western Europe, as well as Adam and the Patriarchs. And it remains the most important historical source on the Mongol Empire as a whole. As source material, Rashid used all the available histories, but also, and more importantly, interviewed the merchants, builders, and physicians, fresh off the roads from China and India. They were seeking employment, and Rashid was seeking everything they could tell him. Ibn Battuta returned briefly to Baghdad, and on receiving monetary gift from the Sultan, set off again in another direction, the cities of the Tigris upstream from Baghdad. He returned to join the Hajj caravan 2 months later, but he says little of this trip except that he caught an illness that from his descriptions may have been typhus. He made this Hajj in health so poor that he had to sit and complete the rituals of Hajj. Ibn Battuta says he remained in Mecca 2 years on this occasion, but in fact his stay was closer to 1 year. His account of full chronological confusions that maddened the scholar, but are more tolerable when we remember that the Rihla was not written to record his every move with precision, but to communicate knowledge of the things that the book's patron, the Sultan of Morocco, would consider important. Thus Ibn Battuta set out again. Where is he headed? Find out in segment 13.